Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. And I know I've made claims that this is a special episode before, but this is a particularly special episode today. Dear listener, returning to us from the ancient past, our favorite guest, or I should say the guest that got us the most favorable comments in the history of our podcast.
Oh, that can't be true.
It is absolutely true. SM Biko, Samantha Biko, has returned to the podcast courtesy of Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork. How did you manage this? How did you arrange this?
Prairie Comics is coming up this weekend.
Correct.
And I am a sponsor, right? Sponsor?
That's right. Slid in at the last minute of me crying and saying, oh no, I need more lanyards. You can supply those again.
Which I was happy to do. So Sam is here in part to pick up the lanyards for the event this weekend. And also I'm like, hey, you should also come on the podcast.
I was also very strategic and took this week off of my day job.
Which I thought was probably the best idea ever.
So that I just would be able to be mentally free in order to enjoy Prairie Comics Festival.
How's that been working out?
It actually was the greatest thing I decided to do. Past me really had my back on that one.
Well, let's let current listeners know who past you is, SM Biko.
Hi, everyone. My name is SM Biko. That is abbreviation of Samantha Mary. Everyone calls me Sam because why have I done this? Created myself as an initial. I write young adult fantasy, series fiction. I recently launched my new book, The Stars of Mount Quix, this spring. I killed myself to get the sequel finished this summer, and I'm currently substantively editing it. It's called The Door in Lake Malion, which will be out. We don't know yet.
And then two
Spring
more
or
after
fall.
That, right?
Three more.
Five.
Because I really just shot myself with the golden bullet, and I'm slowly transforming into the Kroggled monster that I've promised myself.
The Kroggled monster?
As each sequel comes out. But I also full-time write social media content and strategy for the Hallmark Channel.
Bum, bum, bum.
Full-time writer.
Yes, in a way.
On every facet. Like on every minute of the day, you're writing something.
Yeah, which was honestly an accident getting that job, but it's lucrative enough that I can bankroll being an artist as well as running a registered not-for-profit comics arts festival for which none of us get paid. And that wink was just ironic. I don't get paid. No one does. But I make sure that the artists do. Especially those who participate in our year-round programming. So we are this artist market festival. It's 2 days long. And we also do programming. But also throughout the year, we keep the energy and the comics education going via our local library. We do free-to-attend lectures, workshops, many of which Gregory has facilitated.
It's so true.
And Prairie Comics Festival pays all of our facilitators in... accordance to Carfax fees, so that you actually get to draw an income as an artist from sharing your knowledge with the community.
It's so true, and they were very well attended. The librarians were all quite shocked. One of the libraries was so embattled by construction, and like their literal roads in front and behind the library had been removed, and still we had maximum attendance for our Making Comics thing. So I think that really speaks to the fact that parents... So I'll describe who I thought the constituent parts of the classrooms were. It was a third students, young people who make comics, wanted to make comics, sought it out, told their parents, here's a thing that's happening, I'm going, make it happen. And the other two-thirds, I think, were typified by students who had a passing interest in storytelling, illustration, drawing, doodling, and their parents were doing anything in their power to replace screen time with creative time, and we're trying to create programming for them. And so the fun part for me was taking the energy of the first group and transferring it into the other two-thirds and watching that whole alchemy kind of take shape, where the one group wasn't looking at the expert as saying, like, this is why you should make comics. They looked at this other group of young people that were just sleeves up, working hard, writing their own stuff, and were like, I want to be like that kid. Like, I want to have what's in my head show up on the page. And that was the coolest thing to harness. So that's thanks, awesome. Sam.
And so important to have those things. Like, I remember when I was starting out, even before I was into Comic Cons, like, all I wanted to do was draw and maybe make something of that. And growing up in a small town, the only option that was ever occurred was 40 minutes away, there was a portrait drawing class. So I would drive 40 minutes once a week to, like, learn how to draw portraits. Wow. And then drive back home. And when I came to the city, you and John Toon put on a couple, like, how to make a comic or how to be published or how to tell...
That's true.
Yeah, stories with words and pictures. And I, like, went to every one of those I could. And then Comic-Con became a thing. But,
and,
like...
And important to point out how those started with Toon and I back in the day was we were doing some stuff. Mm-hmm. And we started getting all these emails from people saying, how did you do that? And one day he said to me, like... You know, we've gotten like 25 emails from people who asked us how we did that. Rather than respond to all of them individually, why don't we just hold a single day workshop and see who would come? Yeah. And that's how those started.
So, yeah, you guys did quite a few of those. And some of them were like even like 2 day workshops.
Yeah,
and stuff
we did
like that.
Some where people would bring, we did some where people brought their idea and we showed them how to flesh their idea out into an outline and then how to take that outline and turn it into a pitch and then how to take that pitch and submit it to publishers as part of like the complete cycle. And then the final act of the day, like the last hour, was actually sending the email with like, I have an outline for an idea, you know, and getting feedback. And then what was really cool is months later, many of those people getting back in touch with us saying, hey, I placed a book. Hey, I placed a short story. Hey, I placed a comic. Like it was
just so important to like get in a room with people who are like tentatively wanting to get into a career of writing or making art and just telling them like, it is a thing.
You can.
You can.
Yeah.
Like, it's not as hard as you think. You just have to put some work into it. And if I can do it, come on.
Yeah. And also that you're not alone.
Yeah.
And that community exists here where you live. Yeah. And you don't have to dream about moving to Chicago or New York or L.A.
And none of those guys are working together. They're all, like, shut away at home working in a basement.
Right.
Like, they're not in some big bullpen Marvel downtown New York studio that
not anymore.
We were all lied to about.
Yeah. So
never
true.
Happened.
But it is very funny, just I couldn't go to your workshops just because of timing, but I've been going.
You
could
have taught all of them, though.
No, not. I'm sorry. How many decades of experience do you have teaching?
Too many. Look at all these gray
hairs.
That's
something I don't
look
have.
At these withered claws I call my hands.
I recently, they're coming for me. They know I'm here.
Should I shut the window?
Okay. I live in Charleswood, so I live very far away from downtown and from things happening, and so I have really been doing a lot of self-reflection on how lonely I am, although I do put on a lot of workshops and do a lot of things, and I've realized that my role kind of in community is organizer, and while I do like facilitating workshops and giving lectures, I like bringing people together. I like being the one who is... I don't want to say manufacturing because it sounds so cold. But
executive
just,
producing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Just directing. I enjoy that role like immensely. And so I have the last year. And I remember I came into this studio a year ago and I was like, guess what, everyone? I'm the new person running Prairie Comics by myself. And you looked at me and you were like, is that something you like?
Are you happy?
Because
about
you
this?
Seem a little unhinged. And it was just. I was very stressed at the time, and I was like, great, I'm taking on another thing. And after this year, I'm like, oh, wow, I actually really love it. And I'm so happy that I did. And we're now like an incorporated entity. So we have opened doors to have more funding. And it's been wild to see going down and doing these events at the library, just how excited not only the people that are participating, but the librarians who are like, they're so overburdened. Librarians, if I could do an entire podcast about how our civic system is broken and specifically the Winnipeg Public Library system needs a lot of help and support. But these are people who are in the community as a community hub and they see the need, but they need that other component of someone who is willing to gather the people together in that room and get it done. So literally, as soon as you finish those workshops, I was getting emails from 3 librarians. One person who wanted to get your books in circulation. The other person who was like, we want to set up more. So can we just coordinate that right now? And a third person who was sending me the feedback from the actual participants. And it was so beautiful. And I was just so excited that everyone in that chain benefited. The library, students, and you. the artist.
I know that you like chocolates, and you like to read.
And dancing.
When's the last time you did?
A while.
I'm always thinking about your question when you sat down with me at lunch, and you were like, how can we make a comic school?
Yeah.
I was like, it's...
comic school. We did it.
You did it.
Yeah,
you can
we're
do
doing
it in
it.
These small pockets. Community without having to kind of be super overwhelmed, and people need it.
And it's great to have that reaction, because the whole time you're doing a lot of things like this, you're kind of the back of your mind like, is this, like, am I putting all this time and effort into it?
Is this anything?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Is this going to turn out? Mm-hmm. Is nobody going to show up? Is nobody going to like this? Like, you're always, that self-doubt never goes away. And so mm-hmm. when it actually, like, resounding success, it just... Yeah, reinforces that drive. Yeah.
And even Super Pulp Science, to a large extent, we did it for so long, now you start to wonder, like, or you can wonder, like, to whom are we in service to in this collection of our ideas and our mission? But then at least 3 or 4 times a year, someone will come up to me and say, look at my booth, look at my banner, look, I got this printing done. Hey, I did an overprint. I'm profitable on a short run. I'm, you know, and those, that kind of feedback, even if it's just a small group of people who take action as a result, and other people just want to hear, you know, we like hearing how other people spend their days. It's a weird human truth, mm-hmm. right? But other people take action as a result, and we get to take our failures, put them in a pile, sort them according to category, and then talk about them according to what we hope will be useful. And I think that that's, you know, why else are we here if not, okay,
not
this
will sure.
get, yeah, get real sentimental there for a second, but we should help each other. People, dear listener, you help us as we help you. So let's talk about the invisible things then. This brings me to a good topic, I think, for us to discuss today, especially given the fact that Samantha has so much experience in so many sides of this question. And here's the question to you both. What do you think are the invisible things that should be talked about more often that go into making a creative work? The invisible parts that the consumer, the enjoyer, the dedicated fan, the person who loves the work just never thinks about, never considers, nor should they. The burden is not on them to consider those things. But I think from a creative standpoint, if you don't know what those things are before you embark upon it, it can be very difficult and painful. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about them?
Mm. Well, I'll use the throwaway joke lines that we were talking about for this podcast. Let's see, what's the bottom of the iceberg? Crippling self-doubt, fear of rejection, that empty feeling of what's the point as you embark on telling a story that no one asked to listen to or hear, but you're going to make them anyway. They pick up your work. So that is also, that's just kind of the, comes with the territory, author 101 toolkit. But there's also just things that you guys have talked about a lot on this podcast. If you do intense world building, if you have a very complicated sort of setting, all the research that goes into something, that could probably fill 1,000 pages, but what you're putting in front of people in a comic or in a book is like 24 to 100 pages, and you're just inviting readers in to something that you've made without trying to inundate them with your ideas and your feelings and your opinions. So there's a lot of like a balance and a back and forth with what they don't get to see. And I just wanted to talk about personally how my year as a writer has kind of fed into this question, because I wrote these 3 very complicated books. It was this trilogy called The Realms of Ancient. It's a young adult fantasy, extremely complicated. Gods, their own mythologies, powers, apocalypse sort of thing. And I don't remember writing them. And that's not to be like, oh, I just closed my eyes and the book came out.
And not like a Stephen King cocaine beer fueled
no,
bender.
No, it's just that my mind has compartmentalized all the feelings I had while writing those books. And I was at a show recently and I just sat and was reading one of my books and I was like, this reads like someone else did it.
Mm.
Like mm-hmm. that person who wrote this book doesn't exist anymore because they were written a while ago and I've had different life experiences. And flash forward to this year, where I was writing a new book. And it's the first time I've written a book start to finish while having a child in my life. And I imagined, no, this won't fracture me. This is just, everyone has kids and their lives go on and it's fine. And that's been an enormous learning curve over 3 years. But it's very humbling as a writer, because most of your writing is, I would say 80% is not writing at all. It's thinking about the writing. It's thinking about the story. It's just staring blankly off and inhabiting that inner world that is generating the story. And for those of you out there who have kids, maybe you can relate to this, but your every waking thought is consumed. Every neuron has been accounted for.
And interrupted.
And yeah. You do not get that clear time. And when you think, well, when they're in bed, surely you can be productive.
Ha ha ha.
Ha ha
ha.
You're exhausted. You're cleaning up the house. You're looking for comfort somewhere. You're not looking to produce anything. And so you're so wrung out. Even the most disciplined writer, and there are tons of disciplined writers out there with multiple kids, and I salute you. I will send you 8 trophies in the mail. Send me a self-addressed stamped envelope. But that was not me, and it was very difficult. And it was so difficult that when I handed in the book, I knew that it wasn't a good book because I was just so frazzled putting it together, and I was like, this is not my best work. And so I reached out to my editor, and I was like, I'm going to need your help. And I need you to be super objective with me. And I know that we can make this book the best it can be, but it is not there yet. And I just know because I'm just so stretched so thin. Now, I'm sure, listener, that also has to do with the fact I have 3 full-time jobs and a child. So one of those will have to give eventually, but I just found this year.
Hopefully not the child.
No. Well, no.
They can cover them at my house.
That's right. He loves Gregory.
I just want to play Playmobil some more.
Side story, Wesley does not like men at all, and he gave Gregory a hug unbidden.
Wow.
I just ran up to him, gave him a big hug.
We bonded. I nearly cried.
Yeah. But yeah, so being a creative person and having tons of other obligations is one of the bottoms of the iceberg, I think. The struggle.
I wanted to just quickly, the first thing you said was like the crippling self-doubt.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that this weekend. And about how important it is, and how you don't want to lose that.
Mm-hmm.
The way my schedule has kind of worked, I had caught up on a whole bunch of things leading up to the Toronto Fan Expo, a really big convention in Canada. And I felt caught up. I felt like I had done enough work, and this doesn't happen often.
I remember you saying that too. You're like, hey, I'm ready.
Yeah. I always feel like I'm behind. I always feel like there's a million more things to do. Like that's my like 99.9% how I run. But for a brief moment there, I was like, I've done enough. I'm like, I'm ready. And
jeez, you've been at this for 12 years.
And then finally, yeah.
Wow.
But then going around the floor and seeing amazing booth after amazing booth, amazing project after amazing project, the self-doubt started to kick in that like, oh, my stuff's not good enough. I don't have enough new stuff. Look at that. And right on the heels.
I was going to mention some of these things, but I didn't think you were ready to hear them.
Right on the heels of all this come like, well, okay, well, what if I do this? What if I do this? What if I do this? The inspiration train took off. And by the end of the walkthrough, I had like 3 more projects planned out, 3 more pieces planned out. And I was thinking like how dangerous it would be if I felt like I had done enough most of the time.
Mary Margaret Cahill, don't forget to smile, he said. I don't really like to smile, but I'd sure as hell smile for him.
You're talking about the idea of self-doubt being sort of necessary to drive you forward, and you identifying some self-doubt as you turned in a finished piece. It made me think of a letter or foreword I read by Frank Herbert talking about Bill Ransom. Frank Herbert, Dune fame, he and Bill Ransom worked on a couple of books together, and Bill Ransom would often say, like, I'm not inspired enough, I don't have it, you know, Frank, I can't do it, this is a bad day, this is not working. And Frank Herbert explained to him that your reader cannot tell the mood you were in when you wrote the thing. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing enough writing regularly, it's not unlike a athlete. Mm-hmm. You're going to be so much better than the common person, even on your worst day, that it's going to be fine. And so I would offer that to both of you as some balm against these
because we don't have coaches. Right. We have communities, though, that are like our coaches. But you don't have a mentor rubbing your shoulders and putting the towel around your neck and being like, it's going to be okay. You've written seven of these already. Yeah. You can
Little
do
Mac,
one.
You can knock them out in the next round.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we did, though, you'd hate that coach.
It's true. Because you'd be like, what have you done, coach?
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Show me your display, coach.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, and the idea of the masterpiece, this brings us back around to that definition of the term masterpiece. People say something's a masterpiece. That term has been completely misappropriated and begun to mean like, oh, you're good at something. But it was what artists used to show their masters when they would apprentice. Mm-hmm. They would say, here is my piece that I will show the master to prove that I am ready to go out on my own. Right? I've learned enough. I can learn from you no more. Right? So we wouldn't want a coach that eclipsed us so much that we felt like all of their advice was the right advice and you should just follow it. Otherwise, where would that inspiration, where would those, like, because, where would imagination be? Where would, you know?
Exactly. Because the master has experience and has time on their side. However, they also have a biased opinion.
That's right.
And also, they are themselves an artist, and that could be their opinion of your work could be coming from their own self-doubt.
That's right.
And it's all a circle. We all don't know what we're doing, but we're making nice stuff.
Make.
And at least you're making it. Because although I handed this book in and have this doubt, I'm still like, I have to remind myself, you wrote a book, bud. So, like, that's, you did it. Good job. Which, like you said, there are people out there who just, maybe they will never write a book, although they'll maybe want to. And to me, like, oh, I wrote a book and it wasn't very, it wasn't my best. Sad, sad for me. And that person's like, wow, I haven't even finished one.
Yeah, how many books have you finished, Sam?
Well, if you count my secret erotica books that no one will ever see.
What?
What?
Googlers, start your keyboards.
Probably about 11. Mm. Yeah.
What? Okay, so I'm confused. My iceberg my iceberg is melting now because
of the erotica.
Erotica books.
Oh, everyone's written those. Come on.
Are yours available to be purchased under a
No, it was at this moment where I was like, oh, I just wanted to write something fun and for myself. And I invented a pseudonym and I created branding because a friend of mine had done this. And then I was just like, I'm too busy and tired. Like But the freedom of doing something like that is that you don't have to, you're not really concerned about reviewers.
You're not attached to it in the same way that.
No, but it's still something fun. Like, you're just like, I'm just excited to make this. It has the same energy behind it, but I'm not worrying about the reviews and what people are going to say on Goodreads. I'm just like, I don't care. If people want to read it, sure. But I wrote it for me. And that's, and sometimes having, like, projects like that, that's okay, too.
See, spicy scenes I tend to write, like, they'll come up naturally in the writing process, like intimacy between characters or all those kinds of things. But I tend to cut them because it immediately places the work in a different genre pool.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so I found that if I wanted to reach the audience that I see myself as, I had to excise those parts, even though I have to write them sometimes as just part of what comes out in the
Yeah,
in
and
the
then
book.
You just have to go and you kill it. And that's a whole other conversation. That sucks. That sucks that you feel like that you have to do that and that people suck.
That people suck. Well, it's not because people suck. It's that I'm chasing the feeling. And when we're talking about those invisible things, mm-hmm. like the stuff that's below the surface, I'm chasing the feeling that I had, I think. I'm chasing the creation of the feeling that I had as a young reader.
Yeah.
Not the feeling I have as an adult reader.
Yeah.
Right? Because I can read other stuff, and I can read erotica, and I can read this other stuff, and I can have whatever experience I want with that as an adult. And that's fine, but that's not what I'm trying to recreate. I'm trying to recreate the thing that I almost let go, right?
That's another thing at the bottom of the iceberg.
Yeah.
There are things that happen in those books that people read that have been cut out completely, but they exist for the author. They just don't exist for the reader.
Yes, so much.
So the author, and I, to that point, I struggled so much with this book this summer. I had two documents. I had the book manuscript, And I had a document where I dumped everything that I cut out and rewrote. The book was 100,000 words. The cuts were 60,000.
Ooh.
Because I just, again, was like very overthinking. I was just in this like spiral because I didn't have like the same clear method or focus that I may have had in past projects. But I was just like, one of these is a book. Mm-hmm. Like, but no one's ever going to see those 60,000 deleted words.
Well, and to that point too, we were discussing, so dear listener, this is not the first time we've alluded to it on the podcast, but we've been putting together a collection of sword and sorcery stories, Jonathan Ball, myself, James Gillespie, and Chadwick Ginther. And so we've been thinking about the broader spectrum of those authors and those works. And H.P. Lovecraft obviously comes to mind, and Robert E. Howard, C.L. Moore, you know, these people who have contributed to this. Lovecraft wrote and has been proven to have wrote more than 100,000 letters of correspondence in his life related to his work. And so 100,000 letters, some of them as much as 80 pages long.
Wow. Oof.
Related to the things that weren't in his stories, but that his stories were about.
Yeah.
Right? Robert E. Howard famously rewrote the Cole, early Cole stories to be Conan stories. And when you think about it from an author standpoint, you're like, oh, I could see that reworking something. But if you realize that, yeah, like an 18-year-old one of these stories, and a 20-year-old wrote the other. And when you compare them, the growth mm-hmm. in that tiny space of time, and Howard was a, it's been put by others more eloquently, I think, a young man that was never able to grow old, right? He had a kind of a tragic end. But all of that other writing that he would correspond with H.P. Lovecraft about was about all the things he wished his stories could be about, that they were really about, but in order to serve the market, he has to make them sort of this other voice.
Yeah.
And so, you know, going back in our tropes, like sword and sorcery in North America goes only as far back as the 20s, you know? And so within a single human lifetime is the sum total of all the writing that fits within that genre in North America. And so it's why I bring that up is when you're looking at the iceberg, you can look at the whole iceberg. You can see what everyone wrote, and then you can see their drafts, because many of those have been published, and you can go find their rejected stories, because those have been collected and published, because it was a literate time of record keeping. So all those pulp magazines they were submitting to kept the rejected stories. Mm-hmm. So we have now all the collected works of Cull, which were all the rejected stories. Right? In that author's lifetime, no one wanted those, as far as anyone was concerned.
Until
and now,
they wanted them.
Until they wanted
until
them.
Until there was a market right? for them, because he created his own market.
That's right. And so this brings us around to what you're talking about, Justin, which is you see the broader landscape when you go out into the world, and you see what other people are doing, and it excites you, and you know you have a voice, you have a visual contribution that you can make to that. And what, Sam, you're saying, which is, I'm not sure if my voice is as strong as it used to be because of all these other distractions now. And we now have this audio record mm-hmm. of that struggle in a way that has never existed. I wonder how much of the creative experience is being exposed in our generation that has never been exposed before.
Yeah.
And so in that same space of time, right, it's the 20s now. Mm-hmm. So, right, in the 80s, right, or the 90s, what will those creators think about the things that we did, right?
What I hope this podcast is used for is the eventual, like, lawsuits we have over the origin of Meat House and Airlock and, like, all the story breaking. When one of those goes big and we're all fighting over the millions, that's what I want this podcast to be for.
So, dear listener, welcome to our litigious record of who said what first and whose idea belonged to whom. Yes, that's what I hope we'll do with this, is fight over money.
What's that?
Your half. That's split, 50-50.
Not interested. I got what I wanted.
Now, I would like to just impart one happy ending to this kind of... We're just sitting here being like, oh, self-doubt and anxiety and fear of rejection and all these things we've been talking about.
That's because we're below the water surface. Yes. I was going to come up above the surface.
Yeah, so I'd just like to poke my head up a little bit and say that at ICON this year, which is the local anime convention, which is incredible, and I absolutely love the energy of that show, and I need to do more anime conventions. I am always bringing my first novel to shows, and I used to not. I used to just leave it at home, and now I'm bringing...
Lake in the Library.
Yes, The Lake in the Library.
We have it on audiobook.
Yes, we do.
Yes, don't listen to it right now. Please don't.
Let's cut clips from Lake in the Library audio into this podcast.
Oh, I don't.
Legal reasons we might not be able to.
Now, I used to not bring it because I wrote the first draft of it when I was 16, and it was published when I was 23, and I am 34 now. And so the voice then to my voice now as an author is much different because I've grown and I've worked on my craft. And I thought, oh, well, it's stale. It's not valuable, so I wouldn't bring it. But then as I did more shows and people would come to my table unbidden and say, I read your book, The Lake in the Library, and I would cringe inside because of these things we're talking about, this anxiety and this self-doubt.
I'm so much better now. Yeah. I can do so much more. And let me prove myself to you
now. Let me prove myself. And just I would just allow these people to just say, like, this book really changed me, or, you know, I read it when I was this age at this time in my life, and it really affected me. And people have come up, especially at ICON, to say, oh, we read, I think everyone in my class read this book. We all just read it, and it was like we were in a club reading this book, and these people are in their 20s and their 30s now. And I had this really great experience where this young man came up, he's in his mid-20s, and he stops at my table, and he's staring at The Lake in the Library cover, and he's like, where have I seen this before? And I was like, oh, you know, it came out in 2013, it's like 10 years old now, and he's like, yeah, but I... And he picks it up and he starts reading it, and he was like, I was just transported 10 years ago. Didn't you do a thing with McNally Robinson where we did a reader's group with this book? And I was like, I don't know. I was just squinting, like trying to just dust off the memory in my own many-layered mind palace. And I was like, maybe. And he's like, yeah, this book, like, changed me so much that all the people in that group, that reading group, I'm still friends with them to this day because of that one book. I didn't go to any other of them, just your book. And then I was suddenly like, I was there. I was physically at one of these meetings answering their questions. And I remember them all being so critical of this book, tearing it apart. And I remember leaving and being like, I want to wipe this experience from my memory. Because, wow, they were all so harsh, because at the time they were teenagers.
Right.
Mm. And they were excited to meet an author, but they were there to learn to be critical of what they were reading. But he was just so kind and so sweet. He's like, I'm going to buy a couple just so I have them.
Aww.
So I can, and he was just like, oh my God, I can't believe I saw you again. And he left, and I was just like, oh, just shaken by the whole experience. And
I have this image of, like, feral teens around the carcass of some, like, animal they've downed, just covered in gore. That's how they're treating your book. But the truth is, they grew strong from that meat.
Yes.
And now they're...
Yes. And they're just like, oh, they're in college now. And they're like, I still think about that book. And I've done that. Like, I'm participating in their growth in that way. And so, yeah, I will keep that book on my table until it goes out of print.
Aww.
Well, and this goes back again to the Howards and Moores and Lovecrafts, who all wrote letters in their correspondences, were basically like, who are these books for? I can't not write them, but I don't know who will ever read them.
Or how to find them.
And if only somehow, through time, we could shout at them, right? Shout at all of those great authors that have come before and all those great ideas that have come. Shout down to them and let them know that, you know. But we can't. So we just have to instead, I think, try to create stuff for that future and be as honest about the above the iceberg and below the iceberg as possible so people know what they're getting into. Mm-hmm. The creative life is not without its foibles.
I find that like catalog logistics is getting frustrating as well. Like 10 years into this, I keep getting more and more people asking for like, you did this piece 7 years ago that I really like, and where is it? It's like, well, I've retired it because I can't bring... I had that conversation. I just did the Edmonton Comic Con, and I had to have that "it's retired to make room for my new stuff" conversation more than I think any other show of my career. Mm-hmm. Like, just everybody, like, reminiscing, hey, you had this, you had that, where's this, where's that? And I had a palette worth of stuff, but people wanted to know. Yeah.
Stuff. Well, they want what they connected with, and that's, I think.
Why didn't you buy it then?
Exactly.
I don't mean that. I know how that comes off.
No, but I mean, for instance, it's a completely different, artist group, but I follow this. I've been following this woman for many years, 15 years, and she makes corsets. And every week she puts out a new collection, and you get them that week, and then they're gone.
And if she has
a couple left over, then she'll do a sale at the end of the year. But that's how her business operates, is you have to buy
small
the
batch.
Record here, small batch, because it's all she can manage. But she has this enormous fan base.
We may not be big, but we're small, right? Here locally in Winnipeg, Tony Chestnut Designs has a similar kind of small batch fashion business, sustainable stuff, but it's by pre-order. And on drop day, they sell out instantly, and people sometimes get quite salty that they didn't get one. But,
if you want that artist to keep making things, if you want them to keep making anything, then you have to support them in the moment. Because an artist cannot wait 7 years for you. Because in that time, they will either have become insolvent or have quit and changed careers entirely. Because they do need you in the moment.
And I
do value accessibility, and money is a huge factor and a huge privilege. And spending it on art has become like, it's just this. Artist just is not necessary, but it is very necessary and valuable. And if you want that artist to keep existing, you have to tell them with your money now.
And your demand is not their promise to fulfill either.
Yeah.
And I think people have to remember that, especially in small business circles, right? They're so used to everything on demand right now that if they treat you with that same energy, like I just don't respond.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather not have that customer. I'd rather have less customers than customers that treat me like I'm Amazon.
On like Sundays of shows when people get uppity that you sold out of something, like it's the best feeling for you. I sold out of that book. But then when people come and are ticked off that you don't still have copies on Sunday in the last 3 hours of the show,
you
let them down.
Yeah, you meet that person first day of the show. I'm just doing my shopping. I'm just walking around, making my list. And then they come, they come back to you on Sunday, and they're like, well, where is it? Well, did you give me your number and information so that I could expect you to return? No, you just made me sit here as the author being like, oh, I hope they come back.
Right. I don't get too salty. Like myself, my reaction to those people coming back is never...
And 9 times out of 10, like they're very understanding. But every once in a while, you get that person who's
I know who you're talking about. I have a perfect vision of a weird mutated version of everyone from the end of every show through all the years I've been doing shows.
Sludging up to the table.
Yeah. they always make a demand of you, of the work, and then leave a snide comment like, if you were a real professional, you would have enough to meet the demands, right? And then leave it on you that they made a mistake. And that like weird, horrible, metastasized version of that person does exist in my head. But I try to hold them back when that new person comes and says, like, do you have this? Because now I have some infrastructure in place to say, no, but...
Mm-hmm. I have a website
now. I have a small batch at the studio that I put aside for online orders. And if you're one of the first ones there, you can get it there too, but it will run out, right? We may not be big, but we're small.
You tell them, I got a little job for you. It's a temporary job. Make sure you emphasize that. Just temporary until we get ourselves another gig.
I try to also pitch that as a feature, not a bug, right? Like things are limited. We're not mass producing the same stuff over and over and over again. So what you see now might not exist in 2-3 years, so it's more special. And most people appreciate that rather than get upset about it.
And we talk about what's underneath, what's at the bottom of the iceberg creatively, but also the bottom is also admin and business.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Thinking about all of these, you know, someone comes up to Justin's table and they see this flourishing artist with these huge, beautiful banners. Everything's very cohesive display. They don't see all of the logistics it took to get him there, how it took him 2-3 hours to set it up so that it's the most accessible it can be. They don't see his exhaustion from having not only...
They don't see this prototype banner that we've built out of paper in the back.
No, because this is an audio format. they don't see all of the thought that goes into how many prints that you're going to print based on your numbers, based on... And they don't
see. It's another frustrating topic because it always changes in every city, every year.
Yeah, and they don't see that. And then all they see is just this beautiful, this beautiful artist. And they just see that. They don't see.
They see just the tip,
of the iceberg.
Exactly, yeah. Because there are a lot of things that maybe we've talked about, maybe artists don't want you to see.
Yeah.
There are some of these things where, like the authors you were speaking about, they were like, I want this book to be something, but it isn't, and I wish it could be. And they're longing for that. But then there's also that part where the artist is going into their snail shell, like, nope, turtling up. Don't want you to see those things. Don't want you to see how much it costs to come to shows financially, emotionally, energy.
Just a lot of failed experiments, a lot of
raw calories just to exist long enough to make your book. Yeah.
A lot of prints that you make and sell none of, and you poured your heart.
Oh my God.
And then the print that you spent like 5 minutes on, and it's just like bing, 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 bing. And you just don't understand because there is no formula.
Once a year, I do that. Once a year, I like overbet on a piece I did. Like, everybody is going to love this piece. So I'm going to print 2 canvases of it and 100 prints because I'm going to a big show and I don't want to sell out on the first day. And I still have those 2 canvases and
98
of those prints.
And you put them at the end of your driveway.
Justin's been doing, which I actually think is a great below the iceberg, but near the top, like shiny enough that people would like to see it. As the waves lap, you can see this part. He's been printing new prints on the paper stock. Paper is becoming increasingly difficult to get at the right stock quality. And so printing on the reverse of stock that maybe didn't have its lustrous moment. But then when we were in Ottawa, the reverse side, some people were asking for stuff that it was quote unquote old. Oh, do you have this one anymore? Do you have that one? And instead of saying, oh, it was retired, he'd be like, you know what? I think it's on the back of some of these. And he'd flip around and then find it for them.
So that has solved that problem in a couple different occasions where somebody asked about that 10-year-old print. And it turns out I took the retired stock from the back room, printed new stuff on the back, and it helps me recycle. They get 2 pieces of art instead of one. Everybody wins. Nobody's had a problem with that yet. Okay, so like speaking of tricks like this, this came up in my last convention, and I wanted to bring it up and talk about it.
Which was your last convention?
Edmonton Comic Con, but also Ottawa Comic Con and Toronto Comic Con. All happened bang, bang, bang. But so I had I have a couple new things that I figured out at the booth. One is printing on the back of old prints, which I'm really excited about. I've switched up my back display to be dye sublimation banners instead of vinyl banners to help with some weight issues and some other things. And I also now have 2 LED light up pillars to light up my booth and attract attention. And
I know they do.
I'm really, really excited about all these new things. And so I had a couple friends come up and talk to me about them. And people I consider colleagues that I've been seeing at the shows a lot, that I've, you know, worked with throughout the years, seen them at conventions throughout the years, know that they're kind of, you know, in the same boat as all of us.
Imagine, if you will, dear listener, coffee time backstage at the circus. The strong man talking to the bearded lady, talking to the serpent child.
Yeah.
Right? They all have different skills, but they're at the same circus.
Colleagues. I am more than happy to share exactly how I got those printed, where this came from, why I did it this way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then on the other side of that, and we like on the podcast, and Gregor and I both have this, like, you know, high tide, you
raises
know,
all the boats.
Raises all the boats. Be helpful. We're all in this together. But I had a couple people beeline up to me and go, hey, where'd you get that? Like that banner. I want to print my stuff on that.
They're taking and it for I'm granted like, now.
Yeah, so I'm like, hi, my name's Justin.
Wow.
And this is called Dye Sublimation Printer. printing. I'm sure you could find it in whatever city you're from, because I don't know your name or who you are. And
if you want any more information, you can pay me a consulting fee.
That's right.
And same with the pillars as well. I had people, like other vendors, go like, look at the pillar and touch it, like put their hands on it
move
and
it kind around.
Of move it around a little, like, hey, where'd you get this? And I'm like, dude, I don't know you.
Don't display salesman. Can you please walk me through your catalog?
Well, is there a point where trust becomes like metastasizes into being taken for granted? I think so, right? Mm-hmm. So you're a trusted element at the shows. You're always kind, you're always polite, you're usually giving of that information, and I'm sure word of that has spread, and so now you're being taken for granted.
At a certain point, I'd like to, you know, the effort of getting this stuff quoted, designing it, working with the factory to, like, do, like, to my specifications, can we make this work, can we do it that way, blah, 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 like, you know, it's a lot of hours, a lot of correspondence, a lot of time. And for some person I've never met before that doesn't, you know, to just come up and get that work for free, it rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah, I believe it. But you don't know what else is under their iceberg either, right?
Well,
this could be the
maybe
one.
A conversation could have revealed that before they got to, hey, gimme.
That's true. So if you're a gimme listening to this podcast, because we give you all kinds of free info, just remember that it's hard won, this experience, and the best way that you can thank us is actually to share whatever experience you have with somebody else.
Yeah, and that's not, like, we've had lots of people come up to us, like, I'm just getting into conventions, I'm just starting to build my display, like, do you have any tips on, like, how to get, like, a bigger, like, you know, conversations like that, I am all in, I am so excited to share. It was just the presumed, like, just, hey, you're going to tell me how this works so I can do the same thing.
I see your success, and I want to take it.
Yeah.
I want it for me, but I don't also want to work or put in the effort to fail, to learn. I want to go, and we see this a lot. We see this a lot, three of us, whenever we're doing a workshop or a lecture, and people are like, I want to be you. But the fact is that they are not looking at the bottom of the iceberg.
They want the top. I want to be at the top.
And even when we tell them, we spell out the exact shape of the bottom of the iceberg, they don't rarely do it.
No.
Or listen.
Because they want to skip. Because they also want to say, I want to do what you did, but I want to do it better. Which just, I've been comparing everything in life to this movie lately, but it is just Nightmare Alley. Those people will become the geek that they fear at the end of it because they wanted to skip steps.
Madam, what's the meaning of this?
Or interact with you in a meaningful way. Like, I really admire your display, and it really seems like you've worked hard to build it. Would you be interested in, like, telling me where you got this done? Not an assault.
Okay, at the risk of expanding the metaphor too widely, what you're worrying about are these ships that crash into the top of the iceberg, not realizing... Right? That it can't just
be knocked
out.
You're going to get them with the bottom.
Right? Kind of. Right? So what happens is people sometimes come at a public event or reach out to have you participate in a public event assuming certain things because they can only see the top and they're coming at you at full speed and suddenly you tell them, no, this is my fee or this is how much work it takes or this is what it's really all about, and they have built up too much speed moving towards what they think the idea is, which is the top of the iceberg, that they can't steer away, and they crash into it, and they do sink. And we've seen most recently at the big science fiction convention I was at here in Winnipeg recently, I saw some people crash into that iceberg, and they were quite despondent.
And by that, do you mean like they overdid it on their display and set up?
No,
and
they overdid it on their expectations of how easy it would be to become an author.
Right. Mm.
And having faced some failures, they were now, like, extremely upset. And I'm really, actually, I'm very emotionally invested in that danger. And so I'll give them maybe more time than I should, which then, of course, encourages them to rebuild the ship, pick up steam, and then come straight at it again. And so I always wonder, like, when is advice... oversharing and when is it
right
or overpromising?
Well, yeah, that's a better way to put it. Yeah, yeah.
Are they ready for all that advice? You know, it's yeah. like the other thing. Like you don't, if you don't know the person, you don't know where they're at. You telling them like you describing the entire iceberg, like they're not ready for like half of that, right? Like so, yeah. I don't know where I'm going with this, but icebergs.
No, but you just want to prevent the tragedy. In some way, but they just want to get to that port to make the news, and everyone will die. So, so maybe don't. I think just the kind of the takeaway is that the moral of not wanting to crash into the bottom of the iceberg.
Sail slowly,
and acknowledge that there's more going on beneath the surface than what you're seeing, and just be mindful of that in your own practice and other people's practice. Like doesn't make me happy when someone runs up to me and says, "Oh, you look so successful. Are you successful?" and I'm just like, "Well, how are you quantifying that?
What do you measure success?" Yeah.
Yeah.
Am I really happy today? Because for some people, that's all they want. They just wish they were as happy as we look.
But for most people, it's money and recognition. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what they are.
Are you starving? Are you a starving artist?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We had that guy come.
Well, he was cute. He was there with his daughter, who's into art, and so I think he brought her, like, he was there chaperoning her and also, like, trying to, he was on an information-seeking mission for her. So she was shy and embarrassed by good old dad going around asking every artist how this works, can you make money, are you starving?
Yeah.
And then when somebody said, no, I'm doing okay, he'd be like, huh?
Yeah,
do you have some questions for him?
Yeah.
And she just wanted to get out of there so badly.
She wants to go on her journey quietly.
She's going to look back at that when she has a massive booth at Comic-Con and outsells us all.
Because there is no, you don't go to a job fair at high school and Justin is not there set up. Or hi.
Well, Gregory was one time.
Yeah, I'd go to job fairs for high school sometimes.
I guess I mean when I was young. Like author.
And that's why I go. It's because no one was doing that when I was in high school. Right? And so when schools reach out to me and say, would you like to be part of the job fair? If it fits my schedule, I say yes, because you can't be what you can't see.
Yeah.
And
I'm going to go to the next one, too, and we'll have competing booths.
We'll have a little beef.
Yeah.
Right? People will like that. Yeah. Is there a submarine equivalent in this metaphor?
No, don't talk about this. I thought it was submarines. But submersible about this.
Is there a submersible? Is there a submarine equivalent?
No. Like,
Don't get on it. Are there people who can't ever break the surface? Are there people who...
No. Don't stray away from the iceberg.
No.
Because if you were just... What you're talking about is someone who is all bottom and no top, and they're showing absolutely nothing, and that thing you're describing sinks to the bottom of the ocean.
That's a rock.
That's not an iceberg.
So some of the things that are invisible, marketing, promotion, production, editing, substantive editing, layout, cover design, color choices, grants.
The hundreds of projects that came before.
The projects that came before.
That no one will see.
Nobody will see or aren't around anymore, or all the stepping stones that.
Publishing trends, graphic design trends, color trends. These are all things that are below the iceberg that all were decided upon before the book or comic or print existed. Right? Where you printed it. How much it costs, what the cost per unit
was. All those books you've read and collected, and all of the people that you admire, and you basically creating a soup of all of your influences.
Freezing them to your iceberg body.
Yeah, you know, there's that, and that's like research. Enjoyment is research.
Yeah, that's true. That's a great way. I haven't heard it put so eloquently, but that's it.
Enjoyment is research.
Enjoyment is research. When I tell my kids or my wife, like, I'm just going to go be by myself. Ultimately, I'm doing research for a project, even if I don't know that's true, because I'm just feeding what I like, and what I like comes out in my work.
Right. You want other people to like what you do. You're trying to
recreate that
enjoyment for other people.
Yeah. Interesting.
Oh, also in another thing under the iceberg, going to therapy. Very important. If you feel the need to talk to someone else, and unload and unburden and develop more strategies for dealing with your busy, hectic life in order to create art, also highly recommend it.
But we're artists. We don't.
Aren't we supposed to suffer, Sam? Don't we keep that existential dread bottled up inside to squeak it out a drop at a time,
oh, yes,
like ink in our creative
suffering
process?
Suffering makes the best art.
It's so brooding. Yeah.
Until you have petered out prematurely on the mortal coil, and then you aren't making anything except worm food.
Oh, what else? That got dark.
Because it's
you'll
dark.
Be dead
it's
soon.
Dark under the yeah, you'll
your
be
dead iceberg soon. Melted.
Don't, it's dark under the iceberg. So right. Don't go under it. Be well, the iceberg.
This has been Super Pulp Science, where we have gloomily discussed
on a very
all,
special episode.
On a special episode, gloomily discussed all the things that are below the surface of the sparkling edifice that you see on your ship from afar. That you think, oh, that beautiful iceberg. Let's take a closer look. Those things are not for you, dear reader, to be concerned with. But if you are a creator listening to the show, definitely something to be aware of. This has been Super Pulp Science. I am GMB Kamichuk, Gregory to my friends, encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.